Hey, I'm Alok, the host of Build the Change, a brand new podcast from MacBlue about the people at the center of progress. Join us on a journey across the country as we uncover stories about the everyday folks working together to build something bigger than themselves, real change. You'll hear from students in Appalachia advocating for LGBTQ-friendly books in their communities, healthcare workers providing telehealth abortions across the country, immigrant farm workers fighting for their safety in the blazing sun, and candidates in states with razor-thin margins. Listen to Build the Change now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to Democracy-ish. I'm Danielle Moody.
And I'm Wajahat Ali.
And we are so excited to be doing a crossover show. And, you know, it's when we get to do these with our other, what do we say, Waj? Our cousins from across the way. We get very excited about the opportunity to talk with other people who come with a racial lens and perspective to our politics. So, Waj, I will turn it over to you to introduce our esteemed guests.
So our esteemed guests, Steve Phillips and Charlene Chang, are the co-hosts of the awesome Democracy in Color podcast. And today we have the Ethnic Fantastic Four. Or you could call it the Justice League or the Avengers. But if it's the Fantastic Four, I guess I'm the Thing. I'll just take it. And Steve has a ridiculously long bio, so I'm just going to edit it. And here are the juicy parts of his bio. He's the founder of Democracy in Color, an organization focused on race, politics, and the new American majority. He's the author of several books. His latest book is How We Win the Civil War, Securing a Multiracial Democracy and Ending White Supremacy for Good. Just came out in October. Y'all have to buy it. We're going to be talking about it. Steve is also, unfortunately, a graduate of Stanford University, but that's okay because then he went to Hastings. He's a recovering attorney. He's appeared on multiple radio and television networks, including NBC, CNN, MSNBC, Fox, and TV1. He's a columnist for The Nation and a regular opinion contributor. And since I'm from the Bay Area, I will have to say that back in the day in 1992, he became the youngest person ever elected to public office in San Francisco and went on to serve as president of the San Francisco Board of Education. He's a man who's been in the trenches. He's an old head who's seen it all. And he's joined by Charlene Chang, his better podcast half, who lives in Berkeley. And I went to UC Berkeley. So all of a sudden, she is now my favorite of the two. Charlene is a writer, editor, book coach, publicist, originally from Jersey. And apparently she was saying that she will outswear Danielle because she can flex her Jersey roots. But now she's in Berkeley. Her writing has appeared in BuzzFeed, Rumpus, Aussie, Hyphen, and Cam. She was a book editor and coach for a New York Times bestselling book called Brown is the New White, How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority. And surprise, surprise, that was written by Steve Phillips and became a bestseller thanks to Charlene Chang's editorial help. You can follow her at Charlene Chang. Folks, it's great for you to join us. Thank you so much for everything that you do. We are going to start off with a really big question, an easy question. And It's also a way to shamelessly promote Steve's book. And I'm going to go to Charlene first, just to mix it up. Charlene, it's 2022 America. We recorded this last week. We're still waiting for the House, but most likely it seems Republicans might barely win. Democrats are going to hold on to the Senate. Trump is set to make his announcement that he's going to run for president again. Trump is a white supremacist, an anti-Semite, a misogynist, a vulgarian. How do we win the Civil War moving forward and end white supremacy?
First of all, Waj, I just need you to walk around with me, making me feel really good about myself, especially when I go see my mom. But
I'm,
yeah,
I'm a very good hype man. I'm Flava of Flav pre VH1.
It's 100% true.
I just really appreciate that. Thank you. First of all, both of you, such an honor and pleasure to be here with you today. And I don't know if there's going to be an actual swear off, but I'm pretty thrilled. There's two parts of me. One is like the Jersey where I grew up and then left, you know, in my 20s. And I've been Berkeley long enough, like people don't swear enough. So we'll see what happens. But yeah, I, you know, going back to your serious question, I think that as, you know, Steve and I worked on his new book, How We Win the Civil War, we'd lay it out real clearly. It's like, just, it's pretty common sense to me, which is like dance with the ones of Brudnya, right? It is leaning into like having the Democratic Party and those still in charge, which unfortunately is still predominantly white and patriarchal and male, too pale, too male, but just to understand that they cannot continue down the road that they consistently have, which is trying to lean into white swing voters. But it's like, take a look at who's gotten you here and consistently brings you the wins. It's a new American majority consisting of people of color who predominantly, you know, consistently vote Democratic, and a meaningful minority of whites, you know, progressive whites. And also that the demographics are shifting all the time. My child is 11. Her generation is predominantly people of color. Mm. And as we've seen from this midterm results, how many young people are fired up and get what they have to do to, you know, stop fascism. So I, you know, a lot of what has all the wins that we have had are spelled out in Steve's book, and he'll talk more about it today. But there are so many leaders and organizations out there who have proven and have put out a blueprint, you know, have given us evidence of how to win. And all we have to do is just follow it.
So I love that. And I love that all we have to do is just follow it. And it always seems to me that Democrats will love to be, you know, Robert Frost and take the path less traveled than the one that we have all trampled on in order to say, hey, we're here, follow us. And so, Steve, you know, I want to hearken to your title, you know, where you say, you know, where it's written, and end white supremacy for good. Because I gotta say, that's the boldest fucking statement I think I have ever read in my life.
That is bold as fuck.
I was like, he said, end it for good. I'm like, the whole entire country, damn near the planet, was founded on white supremacy. So do tell me, you know, and Waj, how you envision this, and how, as you were, you know, you were writing this book, and you're thinking to yourself, no, this is how we end it for good. Knowing that it isn't going to be death of these older white racists, which is what we've constantly heard. But then Charlottesville showed us that, no, they're young, right? And eager and ready, as did Kyle Rittenhouse, right? So tell us how you make this bold assertion that I want to be true.
Steve, right before you jump in, just to keep it 100, and as a witness, as Danielle and I were talking on the phone before we jumped on, she said, and he said, for good. What? What?
Well, what's funny, to peel back the curtain, is that originally the book was going to be called, I have a file in my computer, it was going to be called Once We Win the Civil War. This was my original thinking. And then It took so much there in terms of getting us to how the Civil War never ended, taking that from the assassination of Lincoln 5 days after Appomattox up until the insurrection, January 6, 2021, and then the 5 case studies I have in the book of the places where we are, in fact, winning, that I didn't have the space to do a third section around Once We Win. So that's really the epilogue. So that's when we changed it to How We Win the Civil War, because it really is about those examples in part two. And then what's funny is that the How We Win the Civil War, I don't know if you have a better memory of this than I do, Charlotte, but I believe that's my title. The yes. Subtitle is actually from the publisher, the New Press. They had suggested this piece about ending white supremacy for good. And then part of what tantalized me a little bit about it is that they were saying that it's a double entendre. And so it's not just ending white supremacy forever, but it's for the good of the country, right? Mm. And so then there's that element of it as well. But, you know, fundamentally, it is about winning and winning political power and then governing in the interest, well, the interest of the entire country. This is, I think, the lesson people have lost from Obama's administration, is that it wasn't about winning over. It shouldn't have been about trying to win over people who were opposed to him. But once we were able to win, once we were able to pass health care, that was for everybody. It wasn't just for Democrats. It wasn't just for Obama supporters. And so that's the fundamental piece. There is a new American majority in this country. Mm-hmm. If we acknowledge it, embrace it, and invest in it, then we can win political power. And then when we have political power, we can actually govern in ways that benefit everybody. So that's the essence of the prescription. We can you know, debate whether or not forever and ever and ever. Right? Somebody had, was it a cartoon they had? And they had people on a boat, black folks on a boat in Jamestown. It says 1619. And then it says, well, they can't treat us like this forever, right? And so there is a whole kind
like, no, no, we can.
Yes.
We can.
Just watch.
Endurance to all of this.
So I love the double entendre for good, right? And the book has excellent examples where you go state by state. And I want to get into Arizona later in the show, but I'd be remiss to not, again, mention that looking at this Brady Bunch Fantastic Four panel, we have a black queer woman. We have a practicing Muslim son of Pakistani immigrants. And also Danielle is the daughter of Jamaican immigrants. We got Charlene, Asian American woman. We got Steve, a black man who is not Van Jones. They're two different people.
I'm also not
Ali Velshi. I've been mistaken for Ali Velshi and Mehdi Hassan and Fareed Zakaria. And ending white supremacy for good, both the double entendre for the betterment of a multiracial democracy and for good, inshallah, forever. The problem is that white supremacy and whiteness evolves and adapts, and it contaminates people of color, and it pits us against each other. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing now the attack on Asian Americans. We're seeing blacks versus Jews. That's happening right now as we speak with Kanye and Kyrie. We're seeing Asian Americans and South Asians saying, oh, no, they're going to turn my kids into a transgender. I'm going to go vote for Republicans. How can we end white supremacy for good when so many, well, not so many, but many in our communities chase white supremacy? Charlene.
I thank you so much for that question. I mean, here's a fact that we do all know, just as women, we internalize patriarchy and we uphold it. And that is something that what we're seeing now is a movement, especially with the younger generation, to really dismantle it. I mean, I didn't grow up with this language, dismantle patriarchy. I didn't even know I was like soaking in it. So change does happen. Similarly for POCs, people of color, many of us do uphold white supremacy. And in both those examples, what I'm saying is it is understandable the alignment with power, because what is the majority, what is still represents power. As I believe power will shift to looking differently, and we're already seeing this with increasing numbers of women and women of color, of queer leaders getting elected. Let's just talk about in the lane of electoral politics. I believe that for the upcoming generations, they will see that what a leader looks like and what power looks like looks and feels differently. And I have to have hope that the attitudes will shift. So I'm not saying that the journey and the arc isn't long. And I'm not saying that all the things that we're seeing are make it very complicated in terms of, the fact that people of color, we're not a monolith, that we do have, different feelings about where we want to align and how we feel about ourselves as people of color and whether or not we feel that we can step into our power and if that represents power. But I feel like there will be a shift. And I feel like we even saw that with each election cycle, we're seeing more and more firsts, right? More and more people who represent and look more like us or identify as us, like many of us here do, are gaining elected seats and are going to be in the center of making our democracy work for the rest of us.
From The New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham, a keenly observed novel of a young black man searching for his place in the world amidst a moment of historic change. Great Expectations is about David's 18 months working for the senator's presidential campaign, Along the way, David meets a myriad of people who raise a set of questions. Questions of history, art, race, religion, and fatherhood that force David to look at his own life anew and come to terms with his identity as a young Black man and father in America. Inspired by the author's experiences working on Obama's 2008 presidential campaign, Cunningham uses a political campaign as his narrative backbone. Great Expectations will be one of the talked about novels of the year, Colm McCann. Great Expectations is available wherever books are sold.
Hey, I'm Alok, the host of Build the Change, a brand new podcast from MacBlue about the people at the center of progress. Join us on a journey across the country as we uncover stories about the everyday folks working together to build something bigger than themselves, real change. You'll hear from students in Appalachia advocating for LGBTQ-friendly books in their communities, healthcare workers providing telehealth abortions across the country, immigrant farm workers fighting for their safety in the blazing sun, and candidates in states with razor-thin margins. Listen to Build the Change now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, Steve, can I get you in here? Because you've been trying to build this multiracial coalition for 30 years. You've seen it all. Your take on this?
Well, I think it is helpful to look at it from a historical perspective. And then that gives you, I think, two different insights. And one is how far we have come. And even like when the different things have happened politically more recently, and that having given these examples and studied them and put them into the book about the ubiquity of domestic terrorism within this country, right? So a lot of people, mm-hmm. after the Dobbs decision came down, it's kind of like, well, you know, I've been fighting 50 years. I can't believe this is happening, et cetera. And I was like, well, they used to take us out and hang us from trees. Mm-hmm. And so contextualizing where we're at, that we have made significant progress from where we were within the country. And I came of age, you know, as anybody who listens to me regularly knows, in the Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition campaigns. And so Jesse went from, 3.5 million votes in 84 to 7 million votes in 88, to then 20 years after that, electing the first Black president, now Black woman on the Supreme Court. So we have objectively made significant progress. And so that is a very encouraging piece. When you look at it from a historical standpoint, that's actually why I have, we were talking our side of this podcast about Stacey Abrams' race is, I knew Stacey when she was an unknown state legislator, and then she's become a dominant force in U.S. politics and culture. And so I have some sanguinity about that race. So contextually, we have made great progress and we are on the cusp of making more, but it does all hang in the balance. And there's going to be additional challenges as we move forward, right? I mean, still 6% of Black folks voted against Barack Obama. I talk a little bit in Brown is the New White about, I'm sure that there were people who, when Harriet Tubman's like, okay, let's go, people are like, well, I don't really want to go. It's like, it's kind of okay here on the plantation. So there's always been differences of, we have not had 100% unanimity. And it is the next wave of fight, because you're seeing some of this in Los Angeles, where you've got a lot of these recordings came out around, you know, Black-Brown tensions and hostility. Is can we hold the coalition together once we get past the is it going to be whites or people of color piece? And that's a challenge that is going to be coming. And the LA, I think, is a wake-up call for that in that regard. But I do think we have to fight one thing at a time. Build a broad united front of people of color and progressive whites to take the country in the direction we need it to go in. Make it an actual democracy where we want people to vote and where we have public policies that meet everybody's needs. And then we're going to have struggles and challenges in that time among our different communities then. And it's going to be important to have leadership in each of those communities who understands and has trust in the other communities. And that's going to be one of the challenges we face in this next period.
You know, I think that providing historical context is so incredibly important, because it's very easy to get marred by present, right? By the present, and recognize that it feels for many people that everything just keeps getting worse, right? I hear that a lot. I've even said that myself, even though as a Black queer woman, you know, I have seen what has happened with the LGBTQ community and our movement for equity and justice, and how quickly, in the grand scheme of things, and I use that with quotations, has achieved equity, right? Has achieved that you went from a time where people did not know one queer person to now 90% of the country knows somebody that is at least lesbian, gay, or bisexual, and 20% know somebody that is trans or non-binary. That's huge in terms of in terms of growth in those numbers. At the same time, though, and Steve, this question, you know, is for you first. At the same time, though, you see a full-out campaign to erase history. Right now, there are, I believe, 2,000 books that have been banned from K through 12 schools, written by people who look like us, right? Who have a perspective that has long since been unacknowledged in the growth in this country and the movements in this country. So while history helps guide us, if history is continually erased, what does that actually mean? Particularly for galvanizing youth that are either Charlene's, you know, child's age, or for Generation Z, who we've talked about on your podcast, who don't necessarily have the depth of knowledge, but now they're being robbed of that learning because they don't have the freedom to learn in the way that you should in a democracy.
You know, I very much believe that we are at an inflection point in this country. And that's why that informs and animates all of contemporary politics. And so it is not an accident that the first Black president was followed by an unapologetic white nationalist president.
Right.
Yep.
And that you, and then I talk about in my current book about there was a documented rise in white domestic terrorism tied to Obama's election, correlated very closely. And so then you have this unapologetic white nationalist presidency for 4 years, which we were able to defeat. And through the work of the organizers in the largely Black state of Georgia, were able to flip control of the United States Senate. And so we're able to move back in a different direction. But this all is hinging in the balance. And I think this is where we're heading towards in terms of 2024. And they're very conscious on the right and on the white right about trying to erase history, about trying to disconnect us from these different pieces, because they're trying to play this long game. That's one of the parts of the Confederate battle plan that I talk about in my book, is they always play this long game, but they get caught up in themselves. And this is part of the thing about the, clearly now we see that the Dobbs decision electorally was overreach, and that they thought that they were going to march us back towards Handmaid's Tale times. And they have now had this big backlash among young people in general, young women in particular. And so all of this is at play. That the danger, both the opportunity and the danger, is that the right does better understand that they need to do these pieces, whereas the Democrats are far too timid and cautious. And so you have them fomenting white resentment and fear, but you have Democrats afraid to call out white resentment and fear in ways that then don't mobilize and inspire our base in the way that we need to. But I think that's the challenge of the work for the rest of us who do understand what has to happen, is to define the terms of debate and engage them, secure in the knowledge that we have the majority and we will, in fact, win.
I think to connect the dots, examples of Virginia, a state that you talk about in your book, right? So I'm in Virginia right now for my wife, who's much better looking than me and smarter than me and a doctor, and I'm a poor writer. And 2 years
Hopefully
ago,
you weren't her fifth choice.
I was her last. I was her sixth choice.
If he was lucky. No,
yeah, and the reason why we're making that comment is when we're over on the Steve and Charlene's podcast, I confessed to everyone that I was Danielle's fifth pick for South Asian co-host. But in Virginia, I kept telling folks, you all are underestimating the CRT panic. This is the same playbook that Republicans have used, a Southern strategy they use against Muslims. And Sharia's coming in 2010. It animates whites. It animates suburban voters. There was no response from Terry McAuliffe. They're like, we'll just kind of waltz through. Democrats were called groomers. No response deliberately. That was a strategic choice done last year. They're like, we won't respond to this. The fact that they're calling us pedophiles. But Mallory McMurrow steps up. White woman. Boston, right, elected official, and says enough is enough, responds to her hateful Republican colleagues' attacks on her as being a groomer. And she said she responded because she saw how this BSCRT nonsense was now affecting LGBTQ kids. It started off as 1619, and now it's been supremely weaponized against gay kids, right? And she says, I'm going to fight back. She fights back, and she fights back as she says, a white Catholic mother. And she wins enough voters. Not what we're seeing, though, in both 2020 in Virginia, and as I predicted, majority of white women went for Youngkin. 2022, a majority of white women went for the Republican Party. 2020, 2016, a majority of white women went for the guy who bragged about grabbing women by the pee. Charlene, and also Steve, sitting here in 2022, how do we win over the whites? What's the strategy, right? Because some people oftentimes say, people of color, I'm done, I'm tired, I'm exhausted, I got to move on. But speaking about winning, winning the politics, as Steve said, and then governing, you need the whites also. How do you convince them that it is in their interest to end white supremacy for good? Double entendre intended.
And quick note, Mallory McMorrow is from Michigan. She's the Michigan.
I always make her go from Boston. My bad.
Yeah. But please, go ahead,
Charlie. Toss this to Steve. I know he is chomping at the bit to answer this question, but I'm going to say I know Steve has a really good answer and it's powerful. I'm an Asian with bad math, hence I do this for a living.
Shame.
Steve's really good. Now I actually kind of wear it as like a badge of honor, although my parents are not impressed. But Steve is really good at math, and hence I think there's math as part of this answer.
Yeah, as we all strive to counter the cultural stereotypes, and that, you know, I am not known as a black man, it's a dancer, whereas Charlene is somebody who is that.
So, you don't want to go against me, Steve.
So, well, I would say two things. There's a quantitative answer and a qualitative answer in terms of what we're doing about white. So quantitative, what Charlene is saying, is that there are enough whites who are with us. And so this is the historically politics in this country since the, you know, whatever, 1790s was a contest between white people. You had progressive whites battling against conservative whites over the whites who were within the middle. And there weren't enough people of color to make the difference, certainly nationally, and particularly in the southern states, obviously there was. But since the Immigration Reform Act, which is a whole thing lost to history in terms of how this country was explicitly restricted to whites in terms of immigration policy, and then that came on the heels of the Voting Rights Act, the U.S. has gone from 12% people of color to 40% people of color. And so now progressive whites in alliance with people of color are the majority. So that's the first issue. You don't have to be continually chasing and watering down your politics and surrendering your values to try to get more white support, because there are enough whites who are actually with us quantitatively, mathematically. And then the qualitative part is there actually is good evidence and then empirical evidence and scholarly evidence throughout the way to maximize white support and to mute these appeals to white nationalism and white fear and white resentment is to call it out. So Talia Mendelberg is a professor at Princeton, and she has documented, she studied what Bush did to Dukakis around the Willie Horton attacks in the '88 presidential race. And she shows through her scholarship that these attacks that are designed to stir white fear and resentment are most effective when they're implicit. And when you make them explicit and you call it out, it reduces the effectiveness of them. And then similarly, this is what was found in Louisiana. So Tim Wise has written about this in terms of fighting against the actual Klansman, David Duke, who ran for governor and senator. He ran twice statewide in Louisiana. The first time, they didn't want to call it out directly. They wanted to ignore it. The second time, they challenged it. And they challenged people to be better and to reject his racism. And that they reduced his support. So that's what is the opportunity, but there's great fear on the part of most of Democrats and certainly the Democratic consultancy they fear that if we call out racism and stand up to it, that everyone's going to flee and run the other direction. And that is not what the evidence shows. And that's clearly not the way to win.
And I might just say, you know, we don't need that many of them. It's a shrinking part of the population. That's just a fact. And so there's also so many voters of color left on the table every election.
Right. Every single day, 7,000 people of color added to the population compared to 1,000 whites.
Hey, I'm Alok, the host of Build the Change, a brand new podcast from MacBlue about the people at the center of progress. Join us on a journey across the country as we uncover stories about the everyday folks working together to build something bigger than themselves, real change. You'll hear from students in Appalachia advocating for LGBTQ-friendly books in their communities, healthcare workers providing telehealth abortions across the country, immigrant farm workers fighting for their safety in the blazing sun, and candidates in states with razor-thin margins. Listen to Build the Change now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
But that's the reality, though, is that Republicans, you know, particularly when you look at the ways in which they hold on or try and hold on to places like Georgia, you know, when Trump ran, he had 15% of Black men. He also had 15% of Latino men that voted for him. What they are doing is what Charlene just said. It's a peel-off game. They're not actually trying. They clearly are not trying to win anybody's votes, right? Except for straight white, you know, fake evangelical Christians. That's who, you know, who their base is. But with everybody else, they just need to peel off 1-3%. Democrats don't run that way, right? They're not in the peel-off game. They want everyone to come into the tent with a full heart, you know, ready to embrace everyone. And so I wonder, you know, with a couple of things that we have seen, and just with the few minutes that we have left, you know, you have, Steve, you've run down states specifically, right? In terms of where there is movement and where we should be testing. And we saw in the midterm elections, you know, we're looking at places like in Arizona, for instance, where you had Carrie Lake, who was Trump in a dress, like literally saw herself fit to vacuum the man's carpet where his podium was, and thought that was like a good look. Somehow she was owning the libs with this with this nod to patriarchy. I have no idea. But she ran like him, she talked like him, and she figured that Arizonians were just as racist, were just as misogynist as he was, and Trumpism, and she lost, right? And, you know, you're looking at a place like Arizona, which never saw itself really on the map for Democrats, right? It was not looked at as a purple state until recently. So I want to know, like, when we're looking at the Georgias of the world, when we're looking at the Arizonas, and Democrats are finally, because of the apparatus that has been created by people of color in those states, that now you're seeing these states in play, what we should be learning from those moments, and how it can help us potentially realize that we can peel off in the way that Republicans have tried to peel off people of color.
So the you know, we talk in the, well, actually it was Charlene's insight around the book, is to, because we were trying to lift up the lessons from the places where we've actually won. Charlene says, you should give it a, you know, name, how we describe it. And so we came up with the Liberation Battle Plan. And that in all of these places that have been changed over the past decade, places that were former literal parts of the Confederacy or certainly very red, You had these very consistent common elements, all of it based upon the demographic revolution, but having quality leadership, having a strong civic engagement organization, having a detailed data-driven plan, and playing the long game. And so there are groups and leaders in all of these states who we need to add a zero to their budgets, is what really needs to happen. So the One Arizona Coalition is the 501c3 group, the Arizona Winds Coalition, 36 folks, they were struggling around with like maybe $4, 5, 6 million. And the Democrats still don't get it. They're still spending tens and hundreds of millions of dollars on television ads trying to target supposedly swing white voters, where they should be spending $50, $60, $70 million hiring up precinct organizers up and down the states in Arizona, in Texas, in Florida, in North Carolina. That is where our majority is. And this is probably we have to have this struggle on the progressive side, is how are we spending these resources? Because there's tremendous amount of money. It gets totally squandered. People are even talking about Democrats underappreciated the Arizona congressional races. And where we're going to likely lose two seats that we could have won in Arizona by like 4,000 or 5,000 votes each. Whereas there is a door knocking operation that knocked on 2.5 million doors, but it was still starved for resources and hand to mouth. And so that is how we win. We have the numbers, we need the organization, and we need the resources, and we need the leadership of the progressive movement, Democratic Party, to invest in it.
Let me ask this final question. We won Arizona. It's remarkable. Since 1950, it's the first time the Democrats have both senators and the governor. Fetterman, even despite having a stroke, takes Pennsylvania. I believe Michigan flipped for the first time and went blue in like, forever.
40 years.
But then you look at Texas. Republicans have been in power forever. Greg Abbott is straight up killing folks. Ted Cruz is like, y'all die, I'm going to go to Cancun. The police is like, we're super funded, but we're going to sit back and chill and have this shooter kill people. And then Uvalde goes for Abbott as well. And so I've talked to some folks there, and they're like, don't give up on us. But then looking at the map, what we're hearing in the post-22 midterms is Florida's gone, Texas is gone. And I want your take on this, Charlene and Steve. You guys have done the math. Are these two states gone for our lifetime, or should we still be investing in them? Is there hope to somehow convert them moving forward? Because if you can even get Texas, it's a wrap.
We can get it. I think most people don't know this, but it's majority Black and brown and people of color. I know that's not the image that people have of Texas, but like today, like not tomorrow, but today.
Right. 39% of Texans are white. So this is the total population and the majority of the eligible voter population. So Biden lost Texas by 600,000 votes. There were 4 million eligible non-voting people of color in Texas. So the math is actually quite obvious, but if we would actually make the investment and do the work. And this is why despite Stacey running up against the obstacles she ran, that the roadmap she laid out remains the path. Stacey told me 10 years ago that we lose by 200,000 votes in Georgia, where there's 1.5 million eligible non-voting people of color. I'm going to go register them. That's how we flipped the United States Senate. That's how we defeated Trump in Georgia. And the math is even better in Texas.
Wow.
And then Florida has more challenges, I think, because there's less organizational infrastructure. But the math is still there. We completely have lost to history that we came within 30,000 votes of winning both the Senate seat and the Georgia and the governorship 4 years ago. And so that showed what's possible when you have an inspired electorate and organized electorate.
That was Gillum DeSantis, right, in Florida?
Yes, exactly.
Neck and DeSantis, neck, like half a percentage point.
Exactly. 30,000 votes out of like 10 million. So those states are eminently winnable and far more winnable through a disciplined organizing, voter organization and mobilization strategy on top of the demographic changes, is that there are hundreds of thousands of people of color entering the electorate in Texas every year. And so what are we doing to organize and translate that into power? And there's far more evidence that that's going to be effective than to continuing to try to find the latest television ad with whatever just verbal gymnastics to try to change people's minds.
All right. Well, there we have it. We should not give up, evidently. And I love that because we don't often leave people with hope. I mean, I guess Waj does, but I don't often leave people.
But Daniel gives a mustard seed of hope.
I think it's a little bit bigger.
That's
today.
All you need. It's a little bit bigger today because our friends from Democracy in Color joined us. Steve Phillips and Charlene Chang, thank you so much for making the time to join Democracy-ish. And folks, in our show notes, you will have a link to their podcast that you must check out and support people of color doing the work that we are doing, which is trying to save democracy with our voices. Woo-hoo. So thank you for listening to Democracy-ish. I'm Danielle Moody.
I'm Majahat Ali. And remember, folks, buy Steve Phillips' new book, How We Win the Civil War, Securing a Multiracial Democracy and Ending White Supremacy for Good.
And we will be back next week if, in fact, we have a country left. Inshallah.